So, to a large extent, this talk, because I was aiming for non-technical, is going to kind of be flying above at a little bit of a distance from lots of kind of detailed arguments you could make. And that might mean there's sort of rather a lot in here, because I think one of the things, to some extent, I think one of the reasons you might adopt this position is because it works really well to solve a ton of problems. And so, to some extent, this talk is going to give you a ton of problems and a very brief mention of how I think it solves them, but without the detailed arguments. So I should say that if there's any bit of kind of random physics I'm mentioning that seems completely alien to people and they want to stop me, and I've no objection to being interrupted, slowed down. This is probably a short talk anyway, so please feel free. Okay, so the set of problems I'm going to give you are a whole set of problems that I think ultimately are either solved or at least partially solved. By puzzling out what structure or object classifies space-time in a given theory. So you're looking at some physics, and I think there are a whole bunch of cases where you need to make progress by working out which object is, in fact, the space-time structure. And I think that the right way to answer those questions is to work out which object fills a functional role. So to some extent, I mean, sort of there's two lines of argument here. One is, look, we'll solve lots of problems really well if we can do this. Another is just, what else would you do apart from looking for a functional role in a theory if you're trying to puzzle out what structure represents space-time? I'll right at the end of the talk, I'll look at a couple of alternative views that I think are really implausible. But and maybe this audience will be better at kind of defending one of them. Sometimes I'm preaching to the choir and I just reveal all philosophers of physics as closet space-time functionalists. I don't get any pushback, so it would be good to get some pushback. All right. So what kinds of problems do philosophers of physics, philosophers of space-time in particular, tackle? Now, I've got four overlapping and non-exhaustive kinds of problem, and really this is just serving my purposes. So, I mean, I'm sure you could come up with problems that don't fit into this categorization and point out that, some of these are very much the same kinds of problem. But one's old metaphysical problems, right? So in this, here I'm going to mention the substantivalist versus relationist debate, right? The debate between the person who thinks that space-time is real and the person who thinks it's reducible to the relations of bodies. A really big class of problems that are probably of less interest to people who aren't in philosophy of physics, but of great interest to people in philosophy of physics, are kind of theory-specific interpretational problems. Cases where you have a particular bit of theory and you want to make sense, work out what the most perspicuous version of the theory is, work out what the theory really means. To some extent, these next ones are going to be instances of theory-specific problems, but perhaps more metaphysical. One might have a set of questions about which space objects of a theory really live in. So you get kind of various debates in philosophy of physics about what the real space is or what the fundamental space is. You'll see that for me, some of those things come apart. But that's a kind of philosophical debate you could engage in. And then the one, I suppose, that really motivated lots of this project for me is trying to puzzle out how we could make sense of effective or emergent space-time in quantum gravity. So, I mean, that's a pretty large list of problems, so you can see that this is going to proceed in some generality, because I'm going to try and give you a hint as to how, if you adopt the right kind of view on space-time, all of this stuff is going to be made a little bit easier. Okay, so the internet doesn't care enough about Newton and Leibniz arguing about the nature of space to give me a cartoon, so I have to have them arguing about the calculus. But all metaphysical problems, my example is going to be the debate between the substantivalist and the relationist. And you'll see there's a sense in which I think that this particular debate isn't terribly helpful in the modern context. But in part, I think it just gets dissolved by being a functionalist. So, and I should say that I can't quite work out how this structure works. I'm going to tell you all the problems, and then I'm going to tell you the view, and then I'm going to tell you all the solutions. So right now, I'm just going to tell you some problems. So what happens to this old debate? Newton believed that space was a substance. Leibniz believed it was reducible to relations between bodies. What happens to that old debate in our best theory of space-time? Well, it becomes kind of a strange debate, actually. In the context of general relativity, right, this theory that has a metric field. So people stop me if, like, this level of kind of, what the hell is general relativity and why are you talking about space-time and general relativity? Stop me and ask me questions if I should be slowing down on this stuff. But so, right, our best theory of space and time and gravity tells us that there's a metric field and it curves in response to matter. So we've got a dynamical field that represents space-time geometry. And it responds to matter. And the reason that we see gravitational effects are because of the geometry of space-time. Right? So that's not going to be the final word on a theory of gravity, because we need a theory of quantum gravity, but that's our best current theory. And in that context, the debate over substantivalism centers on whether that metric field this thing that kind of everyone thinks is in the ontology of the theory, because it's doing a load of stuff in the theory, whether that classifies as space-time. You end up with a slightly weird debate between the relationists. There's a famous physicist called Carlo Rovelli who thinks that we should, that really that general relativity inherits Leibniz's view. It's really a form of relationism, because the thing that represents all the space-time geometry in the theory has lots of the hallmarks of matter. In particular, he talks about the fact that gravitational waves could smash the Rock of Gibraltar just as well as electromagnetic waves, and basically some kind of like, if you can smash stuff with it, it's got to be a matter field inference here. And then, but of course, there's another kind of view you might have, which is more like the traditional way of interpreting general relativity, which says, look, the thing that curves in response to matter here has all of its traditional spatiotemporal properties. It does stuff like define angles and distances, tells you what the natural motions are. So you end up with this contemporary debate about whether you should be a relationist or a substantivalist. And I think you should look at this debate and scratch your head and go, what a stupid thing to be debating. But I think that functionalism will kind of let you narrow that down fairly simply. I mean, it's a very strange kind of philosophical debate in a funny way, because there's a sense in which everybody agrees on what the ontology of the theory is, and everybody agrees this metric field is in the ontology. So it's something a little bit odd compared to other philosophical debates that people think that there's still a debate to be had, whereas between Newton and Leibniz, right? Newton thought that, if you like, space was in our ontology. I might not put it that way. And Leibniz thought it wasn't. Okay. So that's one kind of problem we might have that we might solve. Here's another kind, theory-specific interpretational problems. And I think a huge amount of philosophy and physics falls under this. Right? So in the case of general relativity, for the most part, I mean, you can problematize this if you want. We know what the best formulation of the theory is. And really, and that's what the sense in which I say it's a weird debate, because everyone agrees that the metric field is sort of part of the ontology of the best formulation of the theory. It's one of the essential objects. It's doing lots of work, etc. But that's not always the case, right? A lot of philosophy of physics work gets done in trying to establish what the best formulation of a theory is. So if you want to interpret a theory, you'd quite like to get the clearest formulation that's going to give you the best indication of what kind of stuff you think the theory really has in it. And even once you've done that, it's quite possible that there might be more than one mathematical object present in a theory that you might think represents space-time. So you might write a beautifully empirically adequate, reasonably well understood theory down, but you might have two geometrical structures in it. There's quite a few theories that do work this way. So you might be puzzled about which one is sort of really space-time in that kind of scenario. One, actually, debate that you could set up to touch on both of those problems, I'm not going to go into the full detail today, but feel free to ask me about it. You can actually set this stuff up just with Newtonian theories, which I think is just worth mentioning, because probably I'll mention lots of really obscure physics where we get into kind of funny little counterexample cases, but you can do it with Newtonian theories. So what's the best interpretation formulation of, say, Newtonian mechanics with gravitation? That's a debate that you'd think we'd have solved by now, but it turns out we can still bicker about it. Newton thought it should contain absolute space. The standard textbook formulation these days says it's really a flat space-time theory. I think it's really a curved space-time theory. So do some other people. So you can get into a debate about what the space-time is in Newtonian mechanics. If we lived in a Newtonian world, I hate that kind of counterfactual, but if we lived in a Newtonian world, what would the space-time be? Or maybe just think about it as theory interpretation. I'm going to hand you Newtonian theory, and you're meant to tell me what you can learn about space-time from that theory. So some of the work you'd do in Newtonian theories would be very classic philosophy of physics. What's the most ontologically parsimonious formulation? So which quantities, say, don't affect the observable content of the theory? So, what can we gauge out? What bits of structure do we think aren't doing any work? So we can interpret them as surplus structure in the theory. But there's this other question that's going to be more my kind of question. Does that formulation contain something worthy of, say, the name absolute space or space-time? So once you've found your most parsimonious formulation, your one that cuts out as much surplus structure as you can, is there something left within that you can identify as space-time structure? And it's there that we're going to end up asking these questions about what counts as space-time structure. Okay. Again, long list of problems. Unless you read Newtonian mechanics in a pretty subtle way, you're not going to get a formulation that looks like it has two space-time structures simultaneously, though. But But there's absolutely no good reason in physics why you can't write down, and people do write down when they're playing with theories, theories that just look like they've got two sets of space-time structure, as normally interpreted. So they have the kind of geometrical objects in them twice, different ones, that you would normally take to represent space-time. So Harvey Brown, who I'll talk about a bit more in a second, is quite interested in these bimetric theories. So, you know, I mentioned this metric field in general relativity that represents the space-time geometry. Sometimes you just get theories with two of those. And, you know, there's nothing stopping you from setting up perfectly well-defined mathematics with more than one geometry hanging around, given the role that geometry plays. Something I've been quite interested in is a class of theories that are kind of precursors to quantum gravity. They're called Poincaré gauge theories. And they have two kinds of, one kind of geometrical structure called a metric, another called a connection, and those two things yield kind of different geometries. So you have a puzzle when you're doing a Poincaré gauge theory, because all of some of the kind of geometrical objects that in normal space-time theory are kind of tied together so they give you a single unified geometry. Those come apart, and you have to decide, am I working in a flat space-time, am I working in a curved space-time? So in these kinds of theories, if you want to interpret these, you're going to either have to reject the question altogether about which structural field is space-time, or you're going to have to answer it. The next class of question might be ones, I don't know, trying to think who's on the kind of backlist of people who've spoken to this group, but some of this might be a sort of the kind of problem you might have come across elsewhere. So perhaps in the kind of more metaphysical strain, there are cases in which it appears to be a matter of debate what the real space is for a theory, where stuff lives. One example from kind of advanced physics is the case of the ADS-CFT conjecture and string theory, the Malsardina conjecture. That's, well, above my pay grade, let alone the attempted level of this talk. But we get these really interesting cases in quantum gravity where basically you have a higher dimensional theory and it's provably equivalent to a lower dimensional theory on the surface of the higher dimensional space. And there's this potentially exact equivalence. And then you might think, help, you know, my brain's exploding. Does the world have, you know, whatever, 11 dimensions or 10? I've got to work, you know, I've been handed a theory. That's the kind of thing my theory ought to tell me. Do I live in an 11-dimensional space or a 10-dimensional space? And you might think that one of our jobs as philosophers might be able to look at theories like that and try and work out which one's giving you the real space. I'm often going to actually reject that kind of dichotomy here, but you can see that sort of a traditional approach would set that up as a problem. One I'll say a little bit more about, because have people come across configuration-based realism debates here, right? Okay, good, so a few nods. Okay, so another debate I think that has this character is the debate over whether the objects of quantum mechanics live in real space or they live in a much, much higher dimensional configuration space. So just to say a little bit more of that, how should we think of the quantum state in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, right? There's lots of options, but two options that have been much discussed. So are option one being sort of wave functional configuration-based realism, so the quantum wave function. There's a sense in which it naturally lives not in ordinary space and ordinary space-time, but it lives in 3n-dimensional configuration space, where n is the number of particles, so we're talking about 6 times 10 to the 23. It's a very, very big number, 3n. Configuration space is the space that you get when you give the three dimensions of position to every single particle, but you assign a dimension rather than having n points. You have one point in 3n dimensions. But there's a real sense in which mathematically it looks like that's what you're writing down ordinary quantum mechanics on, and you can contrast that with having to do a bit of jiggery-pokery and a little bit of work to try and get out a notion that's not the wave function, some other notion of the quantum state that really lives on space and time. And there's a debate in the literature about I think some people just think this is a debate about the best formulation or something else, but somebody like David Albert, I think, really thinks this is a question about what's the fundamental space. Is the world really 3n dimensional? Right, so that looks like a debate about what the real space is. And then my last class of problems is a kind of, it's not going to be as well defined as the other problem, the need to make sense of the notion of effective or emergent space-time. So quantum gravity people don't agree on much, but a vast range of quantum gravity theories agree that whatever the fundamental theory looks like, it doesn't look like a theory written on the kind of space-time that we normally perform experiments in, for example. For our purposes here, I know not everybody thinks that, that relativistic space-time is very intuitive, but I'm going to take it that special and general relativity describe space-times that very much gel with, you know, the world of medium-sized dry goods that we all live in and that we do, in particular, that importantly for my purposes, we do experiments in, and that ultimately we have to translate anything into that space to get lab results, right? But most theories of quantum gravity postulate at base level either a theory that doesn't look like it has any candidate for a space-time at all, something that's non-spatiotemporal in some case, or something whose space-time is very different from the one that we seem to see when we're doing macroscopic experiments. And that requires us as philosophers, and I think that, you know, this is the right response to, you know, the fact that lots of physicists are thinking about this stuff, is that we should be trying to work out whether we can give a decent, coherent philosophy that can account for the possible existence of effective or emergent space-time. If I use the word emergent, by the way, I just mean it in the physicist sense. I mean, you have philosophy of mind associations with emergent. I mean, I have thoughts about what kind of novelty should be entailed by emergence, but this is usually compatible with reductionism. It just means some kind of bit of structure that you think is really interesting or autonomous or novel in some sense that's compatible with reduction, where that's all quite a woolly notion. If effective is a happier word for you, feel free to stick with effective. Okay, so that's my laundry list. And I'm going to argue that functionalism is going to help with all of those problems. I mean, you have to do work to solve them, but it's going to be a helpful approach to all of those problems. So let's say a little bit about what I mean by functionalism in this context. I think when I first started this project, I decided I should understand functionalism and the philosophy of mind and realised that that wasn't possible. I realised that I meant something kind of more basic, in a sense. So when I say that space-time, I want to be a space-time functionalist, I just mean space-time is a kind of functional concept. So I'm going to take it that a concept's functional, just in case it applies to some object X. In those cases, where X has some property P, by virtue of which X fills a functional role. Right? So just concepts apply to stuff on the basis of the kind of functional role that they play. And here's the kind of hacking example that I think most people, well, at least most people would accept, at least the first part of this. The concept of gene is functional. Right? What it is to be a gene, there isn't anything to being a gene over and above, playing a certain kind of role in biology. It applies to just those objects that possess properties in virtue of which they fill the gene role. I'm not a philosopher of biology, and presumably, you know, that's not something that going to biological details isn't the thing of interest here. So I tend to write something stupid, like they code for a particular protein. But of course, I mean, biology, just like physics, anytime anybody who doesn't know the subject comes in and says a one-sentence thing, it's always wrong. That's wrong. I mean, it's just not true that genes code for particular proteins. But it is true that if you define the much, much more complex functional role and you, you know, you update our biology by 75 years away from bad philosophy of science biology, you would discover that one of the things biologists are interested in is puzzling out a functional role for genes. You know, working out what a gene is based on all the myriad complicated things that genes do. And in part, it's just not quite as simple as coding for a single protein. I mean, I kind of think this should be really uncontroversial, but maybe, I mean, you're going to find functional concepts all over higher level theories. It's really puzzling to think what you think higher level scientific concepts are if they're not functionally defined. Right? What else could higher level concepts be? Maybe someone wants to push back on that. Okay, so that's the kind of thought I have in mind, that space-time is just more like one of those higher level concepts, more like temperature or gene or one of these things that we might have thought were functionally defined than might be acknowledged in sort of necessarily the space-time metaphysics literature. So here's the proposal. Space-time is a functional concept. That is, a field or an object is spatiotemporal by virtue of playing a certain kind of role in our theory. It's space-time by virtue of what it does, not what it is. That's the slogan. When I first started using the word space-time functionalism, you wouldn't find anybody using it. And I'm definitely not accusing this man of stealing my idea, but it did inconveniently start using the same words for something somewhat different. So a couple of years ago, maybe it was even at this group, I suddenly looked on my kind of mailing list, and there was David Chalmers was talking about space-time functionalism. I thought, that's funny. Didn't know he'd read my work. obviously, talking about something completely different. There's notions that functionalist thinking is helpful to think about space-time floating around in the ether in various places. Apparently David Albert has a draft manuscript, but you know, he doesn't publish anything or put anything online, so I'm not going to count that David. But this David is a functionalist about the spatial and temporal properties of our experience. So I should note that that's not really my view. Not in his sense. There is some common ground, but what I'm interested in is interpreting physics theories, not really recovering phenomenal content or something. And there's a kind of semantic externalism that comes to Chalmers' view. There's a lot of baggage that I don't in any way want to adapt. My proposal here is that you identify space-time with whatever plays the space-time role in a theory. It's a theoretical role I'm interested in. So this is quite different from some other kinds of functionalism you'll find elsewhere in philosophy. Right? I think it's quite like the kind of functionalism you'll find if you start to think about higher-level concepts in science, which I think are going to be defined by their role in theories. But I'm presupposing we can find some kind of woolly common role for space-time across theories. I don't think concepts are very fixed things, and I think they change with theories, etc. This project is somehow going to involve looking at different kinds of space-time theory and talking about the kinds of things that space-times have in common. It's not going to be a causal role, because I'm talking about the role of space-time plays in theory. I mean, I can't think of anything less plausibly going to sort of fill a causal role than an entire space-time in a theory. I suppose it's important to note that I don't know what a folk theoretic platitude about space-time would be. I mean, this isn't space and time. This is space. I'm talking about space-time here. And I wouldn't believe it had any interest if I saw a folk theoretic platitude about space-time. So this is meant to be sort of robustly physics-based and theoretical. Okay. So those are kind of the desiderata for sort of setting up this kind of view. For a talk like this, there's a little bit of me that's tempted to say, when people are like functionalists in philosophy of mind, they never tell you anything about psychology, right? They just go, oh, pain, you know, makes you go, ouch. So there's a long and illustrious history in philosophy of asserting the concept's functional and then not telling you anything about the functional role. But I do want to do a bit more. It's not just the kind of philosophical view I'm interested in. I'm also, the thing that does the work for me is actually looking at individual theories and working out how what role space-time plays in those. So I think that the right way to go about finding the functional role is actually to draw on some work of a local, Harvey Brown. So Harvey Brown's got this view, dynamical relativity. It's a view lots of people have found kind of puzzling because actually it's a little, Harvey doesn't tend to sort of quite express his views in ways that fit neatly into philosophical categories. But there's all this deep, really interesting physical intuition within his work. And I'm very much an Oxford product, and so I have heavy Brown indoctrination. Also an Everettian, can't get away from it. That's totally incidental. So here are some themes, that things I learned from Harvey Brown that very much inform the kind of way I think you should think about this. So this is very Brown language, but he talks about the chronogeometric significance of geometrical structures. What does he mean? He means the stuff that means that they have empirical significance in terms of what, like, measuring systems do and clocks. So the things that mean that some geometrical structure is actually going to get picked out by ordinary macroscopic or non-macroscopic stuff, whatever you think does measuring in your theory. It's a subtle matter. That's the kind of thing that he says. What he means is, what you don't do is just like reach into your theory and glance and say, oh, look, I see a bit of geometry. That tells me what a ruler will do. You need to think very carefully about how the theory is set up and what the details of the theory are, and in particular what the dynamics of the matter within the theory do in order to work out why it is, or whether indeed some piece of geometry actually tells you anything about what the stuff that you think measures space-time does. So just writing down a theory with a certain geometry is not going to guarantee that geometry has the usual spatiotemporal role in the theory. You can perfectly well write down, you know, mathematical geometry that's totally uncorrelated to anything that, say, rigid bodies or periodic systems and clocks do. And he doesn't put it like this, but there's an extra kind of, he's got a sort of order of explanation argument that I'd want to summarise as saying, insisting that there's something about the metaphysics of space-time that somehow shapes the behaviour of material systems. So, you know, why does stuff, you know, so if you're interested in, you know, time dilation or Lorentz contractions, weird ways that bodies behave in special relativity, why do they do that? Just saying, because the space-time makes them, right, is not a very good explanation. You want to think harder about the details of their dynamics. So those are the kind of rules, the sort of morals I want to draw out of Harvey's work, and I think that they're helpful in kind of puzzling out what kind of functional role you might be interested in. So what else should we say about what had better be the case if you're going to get a decent analysis of the kind of functional role for space-time? Well, in the phenomenological domain, and by phenomenological I just mean, yeah, I mean it in a kind of bare sense of the word, as in like the one you and I live in, where we're interested in like what stuff we can sense does. Just because I think that's the empirically interesting domain, right? That's where we have to experiment. Our functional role should be such that if a geometrical object instantiates it, then that object has its usual operational significance in terms of measuring rods, clocks, really importantly in physics, light rays follow particular geometrical structures. So at the very least, if something's going to count as our space-time, right, it's got to be the thing that tells you something about what's going to happen if I stick a load of rulers end to end, you know, or set up a coordinate system with some clocks. And in order to ensure that, and to make sense of the idea of functional role, the functional role is going to have to, and this is the sort of Harvey Brown point, the functional role is going to have to relate space-time to the rest of the dynamics. You don't get that, you don't get what rulers do for free with bare geometry. There's got to be some coupling of the kinds of physics that runs a ruler to what's going on in the space-time. Right? These two things are independent. You're not going to get any kind of space-temporal role for your geometry. So a theory has to be set up such that all of the fields and things that govern a dynamical system have the right kind of relationship to your geometry. And so here's a claim that could be pushed back on and that I won't argue explicitly for here, but this is the kind of functionalism that I would like to push. You'll get those one good way, and there's probably other good ways as well, one good way to get those desiderata filled, to get a kind of account that would, you could look into a theory and it could tell you whether something's space-time, is to think about the structure of inertial frames. So right, an inertial frame is a good frame to do physics in. It's one where, like, you know, it's not a rotating one, it's not one that's moving around in a higgledy-piggledy way. It's a set of coordinates, a reference frame, you know, like the one in this room, intuitively, except really this is an accelerating reference frame, but like the one in this room where if we did experiments everything would be well behaved, and we don't, you know, you don't want to try and do it in this room with a centrifuge, right? So inertial structure and, you know, inertial trajectories are the natural trajectories that force free bodies take, and that stuff's been held over a great many theories, have a great deal to do with the structure of space-time. When you're talking about space-time Newtonian mechanics, you try and pick up what the inertial structure is, and the great insight that underlay Einstein's realization that space-time was curved was the thought that, in fact, you could think of things falling under gravity as moving in straight lines. That's the kind of big insight and the equivalence principle. So anyway, lots of subtleties here and lots of reasons why I want to take a slightly richer notion than just the freely falling bodies. But let's say that inertial frames are those in which the non-gravitational interactions take a particular uniform form and in which freely falling bodies move in straight lines. So if your geometry tells you about these things, it's automatically going to have to tell you quite a lot about the dynamics. Because if your geometry couples to the dynamics in such a way as to give you an inertial structure, you're going to get out, you're going to have yeah, a particular form of the dynamics such that this particular aspect of the geometry is kind of coupled to the dynamics in the correct way. I don't know how clear that is, but a little hard to do without talking a bit more about the physics. So to some extent, I really want to persuade this room that you should be functionalists, and I'm less attached to the kind of functionalist you should be. So, but I'll say a little bit more. So I get pushed back in, I mean, this is, you can get into a good kind of in-house fight in philosophy of physics about whether we should be talking about coordinates and reference frames at all. Lots of physicists think that we learnt that we shouldn't use them. People who think that we should never use, I say physicists, no physicist thinks we should never use coordinates. Mathematical physicists, or in particular mathematicians turned philosophers, think that we should avoid use of coordinates and reference frames altogether because they think they're nasty and mathematically impure, and they don't think very often about what actually happens if you have to translate physics into a laboratory. I guarantee no one has ever done an experiment that didn't involve at some point measuring times and distances during the experiment. So, you know, there's a kind of in-house spat about the importance of coordinates. I think they're actually pretty important to how we think about theories. And there are kind of technical details that mean that, in fact, if you follow my kind of program, even in theories we understood sound really well in space-time, actually the instantiation of space-time structure is going to be, to some extent, a kind of approximate and effective matter. I actually kind of like that. I think it's a feature, not a bug, but that will bother some people. All right. So, that in hand-waving form is the view. Let's look back at why we might want to be one. What are our original philosophical problems? So recall that we had this substantivalist relationist debate about the status of the metric and general relativity. And the metric in general relativity does everything space-time used to do in previous theories. Right? It defines distances and angles. It defines the structure of local inertial frames. So if you're a functionalist, you just look at this slightly outmoded debate going on in general relativity, and you just go, there's just no debate to be had. This thing's playing the space-time role par excellence. So it's space-time. It might also behave as a matter field. But, you know, I suppose one aspect of functionalism is the fact that something's also playing another function. Needn't be incompatible. You're not kind of talking about some kind of essentialist view of what these things are, such that two things are mutually exclusive. A field can play some of the role of matter field and play the whole role of space-time field. We see it does in general relativity. So you become a substantivalist about general relativity, but I think I'll sort of say more about this at the end. I mean, there's a sense in which any substantivalism you adopt as a result of functionalism is a kind of weakened kind. Because all it means to be a substantivalist if you're a functionalist is to believe that there's something that you should admit to your ontology that's filling the space-time role. You're not committed to anything over and above that. You're not committed to any sort of extra metaphysical baggage about what it means for there to be a space-time in the theory. You can also apply this in Newtonian theories. How should we formulate Newtonian mechanics with gravitation? Well, and this takes a paper-length argument, but... Oh, sorry, my water bottle screen. But there's I think, a strong argument in Newtonian gravitation that you get this very surprising result if you're a space-time functionalist. The dynamics of the theory actually picks out a curved geometry, not flat geometry normally thinking of happening in Newtonian mechanics, the curved geometry of what's called Newton-Cartan space-time. I should be careful because I once gave this talk to David Papineau, one of my colleagues, and he thought I'd invented Newton-Cartan space-time, which I would love to take credit for, but the Cartan bit of the name might be a clue that it wasn't my idea. So the dynamics of theory actually picks out a curved geometry, and there's this, even Newton was sort of treating the freely falling frames as inertial frames. So actually, it turns out Newtonian mechanics looks more like general relativity than you might have thought. And one way of making sense of, in particular, a kind of debate about exactly how much space-time structure there is in Newtonian mechanics is to think that structure is in some ways a kind of effective emergent structure. There's very little natural space-time in Newtonian theories, and then you've got a kind of, the dynamics induces a curved geometry in the theory. So space-time in Newtonian gravitation is actually curved. There's one application. I won't go into detailed applications here, but you can see that this kind of functionalism might be quite helpful if you, say, had a theory with two metrics or a theory with two bits of geometrical structure and you want to puzzle out which one was space-time. I think in particular there's several cases where what looks on the surface of it, like the space-time of a theory, turns out not to be the thing that's doing the work. It's actually some other piece of structure that's doing the work. I think that's the case in Poincaré gauge theories. And one nice thing about being a functionalist and looking at these kinds of theories is that your functionalist definition lets you answer those questions in a way that lets you sort of get on with the business of working out what the empirical content of the theory is without getting bogged down in kind of mind-melting, how could there be two space-times? I mean, you just apply this functional definition. If two things play, for example, the role of space-time with respect to two different sets of dynamics, there's a certain sense in which they both deserve the space-time title. You can be kind of casual about the many weird and wonderful things that physics might throw at you. Space-time in the configuration space debate. I think one of the things that being a functionalist makes you realise is that there's a side of that debate that's just, you're not asking a good question, right? So there's the table thumping, what's the real space kind of view. You might think, you know, is it really three-dimensional? Is space really three-dimensional? Or is it really three plus one-dimensional? Well, only one of those two spaces, and it's not the higher-dimensional one, is going to give you back the connections with ordinary experience that we get in ordinary space-time. So there's a sense in which you can have an argument about whether you should think of it as like an effective or an emergent space-time. There's only one candidate for space-time in quantum mechanics, and it's three plus one-dimensional space-time. Nobody thinks the configuration space has spatiotemporal significance. So, so on that front, the kind of space-time state realism wins. You can also have this other debate, but I kind of like the fact that this decouples, because I think it makes what's going on clearer. You can also have this other debate about which description is more fundamental, right? So you might have a debate about whether you think that the formulation of quantum mechanics in 3N dimensions is somehow more perspicuous, more fundamental, on some other set of reasons than the one in ordinary 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time. I have thoughts about how I think you should answer that kind of fundamentality question, but I don't think, here's what I am really committed to, is that you shouldn't answer it on the basis of which one's got a real space in it. I don't think that we have any good way of giving content to that notion over and above thinking about the role of space-time. So you might, for example, think that one description is more fundamental than the other because it's more revealing with respect to, say, quantum field theory, a theory you think has more general applicability and a wider domain, so you have reason to think it's more fundamental. But I don't think that worrying about, you know, real spaces in which things live over and above what plays the space-time role is going to be a particularly helpful way to think here. This will come up when I talk about the container view of space-time, so I'll say more about that in a second. And this is my final problem, the problem of emergent or effective space-time. There's going to be lots to be said about this in particular instances, but it certainly looks as if it may well be the case that something like the metric field that tells you actually how, you know, your wristwatch behaves is not a fundamental feature of the world, but rather an emergent one. I think if you're one of the kind of container space-time type people, maybe even what I'm going to call a mathematical fetishist, you're going to have trouble making that intelligible. It's going to just look like a very, very puzzling thing to think about the world. But if you're interested in just whether the metric field plays the space-time role, then functional roles can perfectly well be instantiated by approximate effective structures. I mean, whatever you think temperature is, it's not precisely instantiated at every scale, right? But it's a very robust real feature of our world. There's no reason why you can't have an effective metric that plays a spatiotemporal role in a higher level theory. It doesn't have to be a fundamental thing. So non-fundamental space-time, just whatever's instantiating the space-time role isn't a fundamental object. It's some piece of effective structure. And you're going to have all kinds of puzzles about inter-theoretic relations and working out what you think effective structures look like. And there's lots of good work to be done there. But it's not that the space-timiness of it is not going to be the main source of the puzzle. And there are lots of places where this kind of view is going to come apart from, you know, what people might think is an intuitive wisdom. I think, as I said earlier, there's nothing that says that you can't have more than one field or object playing the space-time role with respect to, say, different dynamical regimes or at different length scales. I mean, that's, again, a feature, not a bug. I mean, I'm trying to account for the possibility of emergent space-time geometry and quantum gravity, and there's lots of theories where the fundamental theory has one geometry, and then there's an effective geometry as well. Oh, but there are also theories where the fundamental theory doesn't have what we normally think of as a spatiotemporal geometry. Nothing here says the space-time role always has to be filled. There's going to be lots of domains in which you just don't find anything that's playing the role of space-time structure. And they're just going to be exactly the kinds of domains where you're not going to be able to get out anything that looks like a physical geometry in the sense that we're used to. So, for example, if you take on board any of the lessons of quantum gravity or any thoughts about quantum mechanics, there are small scales close to the Planck length, where you'll definitely expect general relativity to break down. In any domain where general relativity tells you that you have such strong gravity that the geometry curvature is, the radius of curvature is similar to that length, all bets are off, and all of your kind of normal associations of the metric field with space-time structure are just going to break down. But again, that's exactly the kind of thing that you'd expect in this kind of regime. So I think, again, that's a feature, not a bug. But it's worth noting that, you know, there are senses in which geometry is going to be scale relative. There are places where you're just not going to want to be assigning space-time geometry in the ordinary way. And that may seem surprising. Okay, so maybe you don't like any of that, and that all sounds like it just does horrible damage to all of your intuitions about how we should think about the world and physical theory and space and time. So if you want to be not a functionalist about something, right, you need to, you know, I'm claiming that filling a functional role, and again, I've been pretty vague about the functional role, but that I'm claiming that a bunch of people who have thought really hard about space-time theories could get together and eventually agree on some kind of an expanded complex functional role for a space-time to play, and that's all there is to the story. If you want to push back against that, you're going to have to argue that there's something missing in that analysis, right? that just filling a role is either not necessary or not sufficient for an object to be space-time. So you've got to have some extra ingredient up your sleeve in space-time recipe. And to some extent, because this particular question I'm asking isn't a question that people tend to answer it implicitly, not explicitly, right? I have to kind of invent my opponents. I'll give you quotes that I think shows that they exist, but you know, nobody writes a paper saying, I'm a mathematical fetishist. Here's another thing you might know about philosophy of physics. Outside, I mean, you can go to places, Oxford's sort of one of them, where there's some kind of happy rapprochement, but certainly in the United States, there's a massive sort of chasm, rather a bitter divide between people who think that philosophy of physics should basically be an offshoot of mathematical physics and basically do foundations of physics. People who think philosophy of physics is basically a bit of metaphysics and do it as a bit of metaphysics. And the two groups don't like each other very much and bitch about each other at their conferences. And sometimes they both invite me and it's really awkward. So in a sense, these two views kind of correspond to the two sides of that divide. So on the one hand, there's someone I would call the mathematical fetishist, the kind of person who thinks that doing really good pure mathematics and proving theorems is going to solve most of your problems. On the other hand, you have someone who thinks that what we need is sort of more metaphysically oomphy extra ingredient. So what can we say about mathematical fetishism? There's lots of great quotes around. So mathematical fetishism is a quote from John Stachel. But there's also a paper called by Michelle Janssen where he talks about the church of the angle bracket, the church of sticking geometrical objects in tuples and saying, I have thus given a space-time. So there's a kind of tendency, and much more in philosophy of physics than in physics itself, and it's how what we teach our grad students, right? Well, I see myself, even though I really disagree with it, I see myself teaching differential geometry this way. You say things like, let's describe a space-time. And what do you do when you describe a space-time? First you lay down, it's like this kind of act of creation that you go through mathematically. You lay down a manifold, and then you start layering geometrical objects on the manifold, and you try and teach people differential geometry by teaching them what all the different objects kind of do to help describe a geometry. And that's all very well mathematically, but then very often one just says, let there be a space-time, and then you list a set of mathematical objects, and so you kind of thereby created a space-time. So David Malamud, I mean, anytime you pick a kind of stalking horse for this stuff, right, if you actually spoke to the person, they'd be much more subtle and much more interesting because these are smart people. But, you know, if you read, you know, a classic text in the foundations of space-time theories, you'll say things like, you know, I shall take a classical space-time model to be a structure. And these things are metrics, and that's a connection. All this stuff's geometrical. There's absolutely no matter anywhere in this. I mean, literally, a tuple of four geometrical objects. And that's supposed to be a space-time. Now, of course, some people will be much more subtle about what they mean by that, but certainly in lots of people's eyes, this kind of gets run away with. So, you know, if that's creating one kind of space-time, I can just fiddle those objects however I like, and I've thereby described another space-time. By my lights, of course, you've described a mathematical geometry, but you haven't told me anything about whether it's space-time yet. So if you thought that that was the right way to think about space-time theories, you might think that the right way to interpret space-time theories was to look at your theory and just look at what the geometrical objects were. I mean, I think a lot of people start off, of course, thinking this is exactly what you would do. You haven't thought much about how those geometrical objects couple. So, you know, maybe you think there's some mathematical necessary or sufficient condition for representing space-time, particular kinds of geometries that are apt to represent space-time. So, for example, space-time is represented by a very particular kind of object in general relativity. It's represented by a rank 2 Lorentzian metric tensor. They have all kinds of special properties. Maybe if I see a rank 2 Lorentzian metric tensor in my field, I see space-time. In my theory, I see space-time. But, of course, I mean, any kind of list of kind of mathematical necessary and sufficient conditions like this, where I'm contrasting mathematical with physical in a slightly odd way here, because what I mean by purely mathematical here is we're not including dynamics and we're not including matter, the equations that describe matter. I think someone recently commented, are you a mathematical fetishist because you still think it's really all about looking at the mathematics of the theory? And there's a sense in which I do. It's just that I think you've got to think much harder about what's representing the matter in your theory first before you think about space-time. But look, if you just wanted to have some geometrical criterion, you have to acknowledge that space-time gets represented by different kinds of bits of geometrical structure in all kinds of different theories. And we're perfectly comfortable with that. And we constantly use this mathematical geometry to describe things that aren't space-time. So it's very clear that no kind of purely geometrical, some list of geometrical criteria are going to tell you exactly what space-time is in your theory. So that's the mathematical fetishist. Here's the more metaphysically oomphy view, the containment view. So this is the kind of view that I think, you know, people have prickling at the backs of their heads, right? In those bad things that we call intuitions. You don't have intuitions about space-time. Nobody has intuitions about space-time, just for the record. But it's the kind of view that you get. You know, when you teach someone general relativity, you give them rubber sheet analogies. If I want to tell you what it is for space-time to curve in response to matter, I'm highly likely to give you an image like this. Give you an image like this, and you're meant to sort of picture matter embedded in a space-time that, look, it sort of has lines that tell you where the straight lines are, and you can see it's curved. So you think of space-time as a background, a container, something like that. So here is somebody kind of pounding that view, and this is in the context of the configuration space debate. So this is what David Albert takes the configuration space debate to be about. There is an arena in which the dynamics does its work, a stage on which whatever theory we happen to be entertaining depicts the world's unfolding, a space, that is, in which a specification of the local conditions at every address at some particular time amounts to a complete specification of the physical situation of the world. Right, so that's meant to be what's at issue in these kind of fundamental space debates. And that's the extra thing you might think you can make sense of in the configuration of space. I mean, who cares what, you know, your space-time role is? What we really were after about where stuff lives, goddammit. I mean, I'm very bad at doing justice to this argument because I just don't think it's very good. But so tell me if I'm being unfair. And this is, you know, and you think this is, has lots of legs. So this is the idea, let's say, that space-time is somehow the arena, the container, the background in which events play out, and therefore functionalism can't be right because either the functional definition isn't sufficient because it's failing to capture this essential feature of space-time, or it's not necessary because we can conceive of containers that don't play the functional role. And certainly, while very few people kind of write papers saying a defence of the containment view of space-time, certainly, I mean, it's a perfectly common objection. I was going to say Oliver Pooley, probably of more of a metaphysical bent than mine, who said, look, you know, you can't be right that the only way to interpret Newtonian gravitation is a theory of curves, because I can perfectly well conceive of all of the space-time structure that doesn't do anything empirical at all. I don't think you can conceive of space-time structure that's not doing anything to the matter within it. I think you can conceive of writing down some OTS mathematics, but I mean, I don't really know what it is to conceive of a space-time with a particular geometry in the absence of what it does at all. So I really just think this just leans far too much on conceivability and metaphor. Any actual content is captured by the functional role. Anything you actually want to say to me about your conception of space-time, what you're doing when you're conceiving, that's going to go beyond metaphor, is going to end up being about how the space-time interacts with the matter in it, and thus be reducible to a functional role. Lots of things I think people call intuitions, actually, I think really boil down to bad thoughts about preferred coordinate frames and ethers. I mean, just if you just already look at, you know, these kinds of diagrams, they often come with lines, right? Nice little coordinate lines. We all know that there's no preferred coordinate frame, right? But one way that we can get a feeling for what it means for something to be the background is we start to think of things kind of moving through the container, right? And the container is static. And already we just know that's a bad way to think about space. And we've known that since, obviously not really since Newton, but since our reconstruction of Newton. I think that the kind of conceivability argument, if you think about, I mean, I don't know how much I ever want to compare this to arguments about functionalism and philosophy of mind, because I think they go very differently. But I just want to point out, I think this is a useful pump for how hard it is to get this intuition going. I mean, I take it that going, the functional role can't be everything because I can conceive of counterexamples, is the analogue of something someone might do with a qualia-based argument in philosophy of mind. And this is, yeah, really not my special area. So, but you say, look, I can conceive of a pain state where pain's not playing a functional role. And it's just worth noting there that those arguments get their plausibility from the fact that we've got this really odd access to mental states, right? So conceivability arguments, I actually don't think they work there, but they have some legs there. They get some traction because, you know, we were worried about the functional role coming apart from the contents of our mental experience. But there's just nothing, when you're talking about theoretical notions like space-time, there's nothing that's the analogue of qualia for you to get, you know, you have the kind of little prickle on the back of your neck that goes, yeah, space-time's a container. But as I say, trying to flesh that out in any way that's more than metaphor, I think, is really very difficult. So that's it. There don't seem to be good counterexamples to spatiotemporal functionalism. I don't think there's a decent alternative view on the table, and it's going to help us solve lots of problems. So we shall be space time functionists. And that's it. Thank you.